Recording. Now, our subject today is nanotech. I think that's probably the most science fictional exotic thing that we've gotten to yet, although mind drugs maybe came close with some of the ideas we discussed. And I wanted to start, as usual, by getting comments and questions and things from you. That is both things that occurred to you reading the chapter, and if there are things that didn't make sense to you or that you wanted to ask about, I am here to at least attempt to answer questions. So, who would like to start with comments on that? Okay. Nobody? Yeah?
I started reading this, and you made this conclusion about the, and you mentioned this before, about the scare of smallpox release, and I had a hard time tying that with the rest of the chapter. I know you mentioned that nanotechnology, it means for not good things, and it made it very well to make replicators to get out of control the way diseases get out of control.
The point I'm really making, this really comes out of the fact that Ralph Merkel, who's one of the people who's been involved in this, gave guest lectures in this class a couple of times in past years. I didn't have it this year. And as far as I could tell, his strategy in the guest lecture was to try to argue that we needed government control of nanotech in order to get me to make arguments against it. And so what you're observing is the outcome of that interaction, where it seemed to me, because the interesting thing is that what I think of sort of the core nanotech people, the people who were doing it before it was fashionable, which is basically Eric Drexler and the Foresight Institute, are all basically libertarians. But at the same time, a fair number of them are seriously worried about the dangers of nanotech, worried enough to take seriously the idea that you ought to have some kind of government control over it. And that's an interesting kind of tension. The fact that people who are naturally hostile to government control think it's a problem is something to worry about, so to speak, and they're smart people. And so I was trying to see what the argument was on the other side, and it seemed to me the argument on the other side is that centralized control can make things worse rather than better. And I was then looking at what occurred to me was a real-world example of that phenomenon, that the issue of how do we protect against diseases is like the issue of how do we protect against dangerous replicators, that in the case of diseases, of immunization from diseases, we've basically got the centralized solution, that the government pretty much doesn't actually design the viruses, but is sort of in charge of doing that, that one result in this particular case was what could have been a catastrophically lethal mistake, namely not maintaining the ability to vaccinate people against smallpox. And I was saying, all right, so instead of putting the question as, if the government does the right thing, could they prevent catastrophes? Yes, they could. We should ask, do we have good reason to believe that having the government in control of this will be more likely to have bad results? Well, here's an example that went the other way. So that's what I was sort of trying to get at. And then the general argument is the one that I make in terms of my two different worlds of nanotech. One of them is the world where nanotech is really expensive and hard to do. And in that one, I'm suggesting the most likely people to create the plague are the government, because defense departments are in the business of making things that kill people, or hiring other people to make things that kill people and destroy stuff. And that therefore, that on the other hand, there is going to be a very large market for defensive nanotech, not just defense against other nanotech, but if you think about all the ways in which this technology could in principle be used to protect people, so that you could, for example, the compressed air blood cells that I described, all right, a red blood cell is basically a device for holding oxygen. And Freitas has got this model, which I'm guessing is right, though I haven't looked at it in detail, where he says, look, you could design a nanotech device that was the equivalent of a red blood cell, that instead of holding the oxygen as a combination with hemoglobin, which I think is what a red blood cell does, it would literally be a compressed air tank. And since you can make very strong materials with nanotech, you can have a lot of compressed air, and if his calculation is right, you then end up with, if you replace your red blood cells or some of them with his nanotech red blood cells, now when you have a heart attack, you have several hours before it matters, because your heart stopped pumping the blood, but the blood has got enough oxygen in it to keep you going for several hours. All right? Well, that's a defense. All right? That would protect you against a variety of dangers, including ordinary heart attacks due to some, you know, chemical weapon or whatever. It would make it harder for you to die. And it's pretty clear that if a private company could come up with that, they could make a lot of money. So therefore, the argument is that with that example and many others, if nanotech is not a government monopoly, there will be an incentive to produce a lot of defenses, some of which would function as defenses against nanotech weapons, some against other things. The more it's a government monopoly, the more it'll be limited to doing things the government wants to do. That's the argument that I'm sketching. I'm not sure it's right, but I think it's a defensible argument at least. And then I'm suggesting that in the further forward world where nanotech is easy to do, now it's not clear the government could maintain a monopoly even if it wanted to. But on the other hand, since defensive nanotech is now easy too, unless the offense has a big advantage, which might turn out that it does, you will end up with $99 spent for commercial purposes on defensive nanotech for every 10 cents that some crazy person spends on trying to end the world, and so with luck, we win. I mean, that's the argument I'm trying to sketch. And I'm not sure it's right. I mean, I sort of tried to make the point at an earlier stage of the argument that this is a sufficiently different technology that I'm skeptical of my own intuition of what does or doesn't work or what is or isn't possible. But that seemed to me a plausible argument. It's the one that I came up with trying to answer Ralph's arguments, which I suspect he was making because he wanted to have a good counter-argument available on that subject, and he figured he could provoke me into creating one if he made enough of the argument on that side. Yeah. I think what at least Drexler and his people are imagining is regulating the production of such machines. So that the idea is that you either you can't do research on it without government permission, or Drexler has a scheme, which I don't remember the details of, in which you've got a sort of sealed environment within which you can do your experiments, and presumably private people could do it within that nanotechnologically sealed environment, but in such a way that there was no risk that what you produced would get out. And similarly, you could imagine a scenario in which you can do all the research you like on a computer in terms of simulating things, but when you finally got your design down, you've got to go to the government or go to somebody licensed by the government, and they will then check out your design in detail, say, yes, indeed, it meets our criteria for not being dangerous. Now we will make it for you, and now you can sell it. So I think the project, I think, is not that anything produced by nanotech is controlled, but that the production and design of nanotech things is controlled. I should mention that the term nanotech gets used in a variety of ways, especially since it became fashionable. And at the loosest sense, it really means anything done at a very small scale. But what the chapter is really about, and what the term was mostly used for, I suppose, when I started talking about these things, is what I sometimes refer to as molecular nanotech or Drexlerian nanotech, because Eric Drexler was the idea originally was suggested by Feynman, but Drexler was really the one who picked it up and for some years was sort of the voice crying in the wilderness saying this was a fascinating possibility. And his idea is the kind of nanotech in which what you're doing is not simply making a strong cable out of carbon-carbon-carbon bonds, useful though that is, but actually making little machines which are designed at the atomic scale. So you can think of the machine as typically a single molecule or a few molecules where the parts are atom-by-atom designs. And that, it seems to me, is a potentially very powerful and very interesting technology, but a potentially very dangerous one, in a sense in which just making very small things is no more, the very small things might turn out to be dangerous, just like anything might be, but it's no more dangerous than lots of things we already do. Does that make sense? So, and then, of course, part of the tie-in to other subjects we talk about is that living creatures really are nanotech devices, that is to say, our internal functioning is driven by molecular scale machinery, by things like DNA and proteins and such. And thus, there's a close connection between the idea of, say, tailored diseases and the idea of nanotech plagues, And in fact, you could say a tailored disease is just a very primitive form of nanotech done at a point when we can't put every atom where we want, but we can, in various other ways, modify living things. And from the other side, you can argue that living things are the ultimate refutation of all of the arguments to say that nanotech is impossible, because here they're running around doing stuff. And, you know, a virus really is a atomic scale machine. Some, incidentally, of the nanotech schemes that people have come up with, I think even some they've done, involve hijacking a virus. That is, you take a virus and I guess you kill it or change it in some way, and you then modify it in some way, and it's already 98% of the machine you want, so you add some atoms in the right place and now it does something useful. Just as I think I discussed in an earlier chapter, the fact that the way of doing the obviously impossible idea of modifying the genetics of a living organism after it exists is by hijacking viruses. That you basically, viruses work by going into your cell and altering its genetic material to produce viruses. Well, with enough cleverness, you can get them to alter its your genetic material so that you produce the protein that by great bad fortune you were born unable to produce, and now you no longer are, this is the bubble boy, if you remember it, the people who basically don't have a functioning immune system, and we know why they don't have it, and apparently it is actually possible to modify their genetics so they do at least an imperfect job of what the rest of us do, and therefore are more likely to survive. All right, that's a long digression, but anyway, so other comments, questions? None of you found this exciting enough to be the source of lots of questions and ideas. Let me say a little bit about how nanotech is different. If you say, look, there are all sorts of technologies out there. Your cell phone is a high technology. Your laptop is a high technology. The floss you use for your teeth is a high technology, developed by the same guy who did Gore-Tex fabric, at least with cloth I use for my teeth is because it's better than the other versions, all sorts of stuff around. What's special about this technology? And I think the answer is that there are at least four different ways in which it is different from other existing technologies. One of them is you can build very small things, where very small things in a context in which a human hair is a very large thing, or in which a transistor is a very large thing, or in which the CPU of your computer is a very large thing. So if you think about the idea of the cell repair machine as one example, if you could build a functioning machine with its own computer in it that was much smaller than a human cell, that's got obvious potentials for a sort of general purpose, you know, the ultimate medicine, as it were, because it's programmed to recognize all the things that could be wrong with a cell. Maybe if it's afraid that maybe your DNA has been altered as it goes through your body, it does DNA analysis of 20 cells, and when the 21st cell has got something different, it says, aha, that's what's wrong with it. Put it back like the other 20, that kind of thing. Right. So one possibility is very, very small things. Can you think of other examples where if you had very small things, they could do stuff that we can't do with current technology? What else might you like to be able to do with lots and lots and lots of very, very small machines? Right, we're interested in small machines because we can fit in there, fit in our pockets, but we're now talking about many orders of magnitude smaller than that. Yeah?
The concept of hijacking a virus, did you say on a molecular level could potentially cure many diseases? I have no background.
Yeah.
I think the concept is the idea of having a small oxygen tank seems a little beyond me.
What? You already have small oxygen.
Well, I have blood cells, but right. The fact that when I'm trying to imagine how this would work, and the way that I read this, I'm kind of brushing through it, but it seemed like storage-wise, like where would we keep those? Where do you
think we keep this? Place we keep the present one.
In a red blood cell.
You would have 10% fewer red blood cells, and they would be replaced by 10% fake red blood cells in your bloodstream. That's the idea, is that it goes into your bloodstream just like red blood cells, and what percentage, I don't know, I'm just making up numbers, but that you would have a sizable fraction of what was normally functioning as red blood cells would be these artificial ones. And the only difference is they would hold much more oxygen, and therefore, whereas currently, if your heart starts beating, you know, you're dead in a few, a minute or something, a fairly short period of time. Now, if your heart starts beating, you're dead in a few hours.
Are they mobilized? I mean, isn't that like one of the functions of the heart is to like move the blood around?
Of course, but why does it have to move the blood around?
To get
what to your brain, Norm?
Oxygen.
That's right. So the present system, because the blood cell won't hold very much oxygen, it's got to keep going back to the lungs, picking up oxygen, and then going back to the rest of your body to give it the oxygen. Mm-hmm. If it has 100 or 1,000 times as much oxygen, then it only has to refill 100 or 1,000 as often.
Okay, I see where you're going.
And therefore, if it stops moving, you have until you exhaust it.
Okay.
And until you exhaust it is much, much longer than with a present blood cell. That's the theory, at least, of that.
Okay.
But that isn't, but you're right, that's another example where a compressed oxygen tank this big would not be much use to you because it wouldn't go through your veins, but one half the size of a cell could be very useful to you. Right? So that's another example. What about, think about the problem of pollution.
All right.
The pollution basically involves chemical compounds that are in some way undesirable. Well, if it's a chemical compound, there's a bunch of atoms stuck together in some way. So if you've got a little tiny machine which is specialized at finding that particular compound and taking it apart, that would be a way in which, say, water pollution could be eliminated, or some kinds of water pollution could be eliminated. So those would all be examples of ways in which the very fact you can make microscopically, actually more than microscopically in a sense, small things. I don't know if any of you tried to think through Avogadro's number, which I gave at the beginning, but it's sort of a useful way of getting some feel of just how big we are compared to atoms. Avogadro's number is about 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So for those of you with a scientific background, 10 to the 23rd is 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, between the natural unit of mass for atoms, which is the weight of a single proton or neutron, and the natural unit of weight that we're used to, which some of us are used to, which is the gram. All right, so 6 times 10 to the 23rd hydrogen atoms weigh a gram, and that means that anything we can see is a large enough number of atoms such that we could spend our lifetime counting them, so to speak. It wouldn't get very far. That way of putting it makes any sense. All right. So one feature of nanotech is that it can make very small things. Another feature is that it can make very strong things. So one of the things we'll be discussing in a later chapter, one of the really bizarre, neat ideas, is a space elevator. All right. If you think about it, a rocket ship, a rocket is a very inefficient way of lifting stuff. All right. An elevator is a very efficient way of lifting stuff because all you're doing is putting in the energy necessary to lift it. Right. You're not heating the air. You're not moving tons of metal in order to get your little payload up. You're just lifting something. And somebody pointed out quite a long time ago, a Russian in fact, it turns out that we make fun of the Russians' claim to have invented everything. In space, it's close to true, in that the first proposal for a multi-stage rocket, which is what we actually use to put up satellites, was in fact made by a Russian, probably before the Soviet Union, I would guess. And apparently, the first proposal for a space elevator, although it's one of these ideas that like 8 different people have separately invented, but the earliest one was, I think, a Leningrad engineer who proposed the idea. But the basic idea for a space elevator is that you have a satellite in orbit and you hang a very long cable down to the ground. All right? And how is that possible? Well, to begin with, if it's in geosynchronous orbit, so it's always above the same point in the ground, then you let down a cable. What holds that cable up? Well, the satellite is at the point where, speaking loosely, the centrifugal force as it goes around just balances gravity. Something below that moving at the same angular velocity and less than balances, so you get a pull down from the cable. So you let out another cable going up. That one pulls up the other way. It has the opposite effect. The centrifugal force is larger than gravity. Consequently, if you do it right, they balance. That's the space elevator idea. And you just run capsule up and down the elevator. There's only one very small technical. Let me exaggerate. There's one small technical problem with a space elevator, and that is that no known material is anywhere close to strong enough to build one. Because you're talking about a cable, I don't remember what geosync is, I say in the book somewhere, but it's maybe 100,000 miles up. And you can make a cable that's a few miles long out of Kevlar that won't break under its own weight, but much beyond that starts doing it. Apparently, if you make a cable that's straight carbon fiber, where it's just carbon bonded to carbon bonded to carbon, so with all atomic bonds and nothing else, people estimate you can make one strong enough to do it, to do a space elevator, which is sort of a neat, crazy idea. It's got some other practical problems, but it's still a very clever idea for a way of doing something we like to do. That we have later, in the later chapter on space, one of the critical variables, if you want to imagine really doing much useful in space, is the cost of getting stuff off Earth. And that at current costs, it's really hard to imagine that we could do very much in space, because you're talking about, I don't know what it is, many thousands of dollars per pound, I think. Whereas a space elevator could bring that way down, at which point now it begins to make sense. So strong materials, and you can think of lots of other applications, you know, less extreme than that. I mentioned the idea in the book that you could make your windshield out of diamond. Diamond is not very expensive if you can assemble the atoms, because what is diamond made of? It's pure carbon. All right, coal is pretty cheap stuff. So given the windshield wouldn't be nanotech in the sense that it wouldn't be machinery, but it would be built by nanotech because it would be a windshield in which it would each atom where you want it. All right, so that would be an example where you could make a nice, hard, transparent material. Might be a little bit confusing because diamond has a high index of refraction, so you've got to worry about things not being where they seem to be because the light's being bad as it goes through it, so you have to do some careful design to make sure you don't crash your diamond windshield car, but it's all right if you do crash it, at least the windshield won't break. Many other things will break, but it hopefully won't break because it's well designed. So very, very strong materials are another possibility. And note that that could be a very useful possibility well short of my space elevator. Because suppose we're talking not about space elevators, but about ordinary rocket ships. If you had a material 10 times as strong for its weight as current materials, that means that your rocket ship could weigh a tenth as much and still be functional. And that means that the payload could be all of that extra weight. Right. Think about a rocket ship. It's got a certain ability to lift. What's it doing with the current rockets we use to launch satellites? Almost all of its work is going to lift itself. And a little bit is going to lift the satellite. If we can make the equivalent of that rocket just as strong, it weighs a tenth as much, we've suddenly gone from lifting, you know, a 100-pound satellite to lifting a 5-ton satellite or something like that. So big advantage. So that doesn't require anything as exotic as a space elevator, but that's one place. I mean, part of what I'm thinking about is at what point changes in degree become changes in kind. Right? That's one of the questions you may want to think about in a lot of these. Think of, we were talking about AI before class started. And at what point, there's a certain sense in which we've always had AI. We've had slide rules. We have had various things which do for us some of the things that you can do with your mind. And what's the point at which that becomes really a change in kind rather than degree, at which somehow the world is really different because you can do things? And I don't know, does Google make it? You know, there's a certain sense in which when I think about it, it occurs to me that the world is an awful lot easier than it was 20 years ago. And why is it an awful lot easier? Because when I want to buy something, I don't have to go through catalogs. I just go up on the web, first I check Amazon, but if Amazon doesn't do it, I do a Google search. Not only can I, in a minute or two, find who is selling the particular kind of laptop battery that I need or whatever it is, I can also find reviews by 20 random people, which will give me some reasonable idea of whether it's worth it. And that just wasn't doable. So maybe that's beginning to be a changing kind. But what's the really big changing kind for AI? What's the point at which AI makes the world a radically different world than it now is?
Turing test.
What?
The Turing test.
That might be one test. But putting it differently, human-level AI. The point at which what you're talking about is not a machine that can do, that can take a little bit of the load of what we're already doing off of us, but a machine that is at least as smart as we are, which probably means that it's much smarter at certain things and much less smart at others. And you could then imagine one of the things that might give you is free will. You might have an AI that actually made its own decisions, and that gets sort of scary because it might have different objectives than we do. But it also just gives you a sort of a very different world. Well, with nanotech, the question is, what are the points at which this happens? And the fact that you can make very small things wouldn't be a change in kind if it meant that the CPU of your computer was a millionth as big. All right? Because it's not the CPU that controls the computer anyway. It's the size of the screen and the keyboard and stuff. But it does become a change in kind when it means that medical technology involves devices much smaller than a cell that can go into your cell and fix things. Or even if you think about the ways in which you now put in a pump instead of a heart, which I think they've got as an alternative to heart transplants, and you can think of other things of that sort, that's beginning to get sort of a noticeable difference. But imagine that we can do it with machines that are at least as good as the parts of our body they replace. Now it's really a different world. Now a whole bunch of the things that have been with human beings forever suddenly disappear. You now don't have to worry about being born with a bad heart. Once you discover you've got a heart, fine, you order a replacement. And similarly for, kidney failure and all sorts of other things. So that's one of the places where you can certainly imagine. It doesn't have to be nanotech. All right? The alternative for the heart, of course, is to grow it. All right? That looks like an easier problem, after all. We've already, we can reverse engineer the heart. I mean, everybody's got one, right? Just look at it, maybe wait till somebody's dead so you can take it out of them without hurting him. And with a biological technology more advanced than our present, and not radically more advanced, you figure out how to grow from your own cells so there's no compatibility problem, a heart just like the one in you to replace, except it doesn't have whatever's wrong with the one in you, and you replace it. All right, so that would be something where either nanotech or a sufficiently sophisticated biotech could do it, and I'm betting on the biotech first because we're already starting to do that. As you may know, that they're already starting to grow replacement organs, not as fancy as a heart, by making some kind of a structure, an artificial structure, and letting cells build onto that structure. We see news stories about this occasionally. But if you had a really well-developed sort of Drexlerian nanotech, now it starts being easy, and you can now make a much better heart. I don't know what kind of heart crisis would the guy who came up with the red blood cells would come up with, but I bet he could come up with a heart which would be much better than the ones that you've now got. If you have the technology, so you could really put every atom where you want it if you built stuff. All right. Make sense? So stronger and smaller are two of them. And then there are two other features which are a little less obvious, but maybe even more radical, I'm not sure. And one of them is really the subject of the title of the chapter, a very small, whatever you call those things,
Legos.
And that's the idea that if the way you are building something is you've got 90 kinds of identical parts, the parts themselves are really cheap, they're called atoms, and all you do is plug them together. So at that point, it looks as though you've potentially got a construction technology which is just enormously cheaper than the kind of production technology you take a bunch of stuff and you meld it and you shape it and you polish it and you drill it and you do all sorts of complicated things to it. Now you just plug pieces together. All right? So if you try to imagine, for any of you who have played with Legos, or the equivalent of Legos. If you try to imagine what the world would be like if, A, cars could be made out of Legos, and B, we could make simple automated machines that would assemble the Legos for us. Building cars is a whole lot cheaper than that. All right. So the idea of making everything out of interchangeable spare parts called atoms is the third very powerful idea that makes it very cheap. On the other hand, there's a flip side to that, and that is, if you imagine the description for a car, I bet that a full description of my car would easily fit on the hard drive of my computer. Full description, I mean, every piece, how it goes, what shape and size it is. So if it was paper, it would be a big stack of paper, I'm sure, whatever describes your car, but not that. But now imagine a description of my car, which is saying where every atom goes. All right. There is no computer in the world that could come close to holding that information. So one way of putting it is, for building, as long as you're running small nanotech devices, the design problem is in principle no harder than our present design problems. All right. If your nanotech device consists of 5,000 atoms, which is my impression of what some of the designs, I don't remember how much the red blood cell is, maybe it's 100,000. It's the kind of numbers you can count if you're patient enough. Well, that's like building a car. A car probably has thousands of pieces in it. And so the design problem on that scale is like design problem now. But now suppose what you're building is a nanotech car. So a nanotech car is physically the same size as an ordinary car. The only difference is that instead of saying this part goes here, you're saying this atom goes here. Right, that becomes a much, much more complicated design problem. And there are obviously some ways to simplify it, because there's a lot of redundancy, all right? Almost every cubic nanometer or cubic centimeter or whatever of the windshield is just like the one next to it. So you have a design for a little tiny bit of it, and you then say, all right, you know, any of you who worked with Excel, you know, you spread down this thing. You've got your formula, you select the column, and you say, make a copy of that formula for every cell in the column. Well, you can do the same thing. But still, if you're going to try to fully exploit the power of building things with the atomic scale, you're going to want an awful lot more detail than we're building things out of crude chunks of material, which is what we've been doing for the last 100,000 years, or whatever, like human beings and stuff. I think the definition of human being, I guess, determines how long that is. So that means that you combine a world where, it looks as though you combine a world where manufacturing is potentially cheap with a world where design is potentially expensive. And that's what first intrigued me. I first got into this, God, 30 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, when some of the same people, probably the Forsyth Institute, had a conference at MIT on nanotech. And what intrigued me was the economics. And I said, all right, suppose that these amazing things really happen, what does the economy look like? And as you may know, there have been a number of science fiction stories which take one side or another of the idea that an economy like this would ruin the world. All right, there's such a good story somewhere where the aliens want to destroy human civilization, so they drop a duplicator. All right, a duplicator, a simple little box, put anything into it and makes an exact copy. They drop two duplicators. After a while, it occurs to somebody, you put one duplicator into the other, and now you've got lots of duplicators. And the theory of one version of this science fiction, which I think different people have done different stories along these lines, is now everything collapses. Because, you know, how can you have a functioning economy when everything is free? And the other version is, nah, it's not a problem at all. After all, software is duplicatable already. There are other things that you can duplicate. You can, you know, make copies of photographs. It's just that the economy will change accordingly, and you won't have a high price for a diamond ring, because diamonds are now really cheap with your duplicator. As long as there's one diamond ring, you know, you want a copy of the Hope Diamond? Well, we'll make an arrangement with the museum, and they'll make one copy and give it to us, and then we'll make 1,000 copies and give everybody who wants a Hope Diamond. All right? So, but that's all right. That just means Hope Diamonds are now cheap. Back rubs are still expensive. Land is still, right? Land is still expensive. Babysitting is still expensive, not maybe some other technology will change that. You just think of the duplicator. The real effect of the duplicator is not that there is no market and no income and no that. It's just that relative prices change radically.
There's still a market for the energy and the raw carbon.
Yes.
But you can't
Well, yeah, carbon is pretty cheap, though. Yes, so that's right. If you wanted to build really big things, you have to worry about the raw material. But Hope Diamond is pretty small. I mean, Hope Diamond is one lump of coal, basically. So that's not going to cost you very much, I don't think. But no, you're right. You still have energy. You have raw materials. Although I'm not sure if the duplicator used raw materials or not. Nanotech does, but it may have used magic. I'm not sure.
There would be a lot of energy.
Yeah, right. There'd be a lot of energy if it didn't use raw materials, but I'm not. Long enough since I read any of these stories, so I don't remember if they went into those details. But I may have told you the story about apple peeling machines. There was a very good friend of my parents, one of their closest friends. I noticed when I was reading my parents' autobiography that mother described her as, I think, the most nearly perfect human being she had known, who was this crazy, interesting lady by the name of Dorothy Brady. She was an economic historian. And among other things, she taught me how to make kids love you, which is to always bring them some very small present when you come to visit, which she always did. But they were interesting friends, because she was the sort of person, for those of you who are familiar with the Whole Earth Catalog, maybe you're not, maybe it was too early. She was before that, but it was sort of how to do interesting things, you know, how to build a weird-shaped house, how to preserve food in the wilderness, how to, and she was that kind of person who was always interested in all sorts of odd things. And one of the things she did was to research apple peeling machines. I don't know how many of you are familiar. This is a very common gadget. It's not this big. You can still buy them. You stick the apple on the tongs, and you turn the handle, and there's a blade here that peels it, and in some versions there are some blades that cut it into quarters or eighths while you do it, and it's sort of a way of and I suppose it would be mostly useful if you were making apple pies or applesauce or something like that. If you're eating one apple, you don't need an apple peeling machine. Peel doesn't taste bad anything. But if you imagine that you needed a lot of apples, it makes sense. And we spent our summers in New Hampshire and Vermont, up north of Hanover, for those of you who know the area, and she would come visit. And one of her research projects was going through New England museums looking at apple peeling machines. And the pattern that she observed was that the basic design had been the same for a couple of hundred years, but the farther back you went, the more of them was wood and the less was metal. Because as you go back in time, steel gets more expensive and labor gets relatively less expensive. And wood is always out there, but wood, you can't melt wood and cast wood, so somebody's got to actually shape the wood by hand. At least 200 years ago they do. So that was sort of a neat illustration of one of the simple, important principles of economic history, which is that how you do things depends on relative prices. All right? That it's perfectly reasonable to do things in way X when labor is cheap and steel is expensive, and it would be crazy when labor is expensive and steel is cheap. And it's sort of easy to make mistakes because we're used to the world we live in and not the world other people live in. All right? Does that point make sense to you? So similarly, the duplicator just means that certain things that used to be expensive are cheap, but other things aren't. World adjusts. And there's at least one science fiction story I remember they got it right, which, you know, the aliens are very disappointed when our economy doesn't collapse. We're perfectly happy. We now have lots of fun. So nanotech, in a sense, is like that. It's not the same technology, but it's a case where some things that are now hard to do get really easy to do. And other things are still expensive. So designs are still expensive. Some raw materials are expensive, some aren't. Not as many, because a lot of raw materials are actually very common. It's just they're not common in a pure form. And presumably one of the things your nanotech devices could probably do is to separate out the aluminum. Aluminum, I think, is one of the first or second or third most common material in the Earth's surface. But what makes aluminum for a while was very expensive because isolating the metal aluminum from aluminum compounds by chemical processes was very, very hard. And that's why Napoleon III, does anyone know who Napoleon III was? I don't know how much history people were. Napoleon III was, I think, a nephew. He was a relative but not a descendant of the famous Napoleon. And he made himself ruler of France for a few years in the 19th century. Then there was a war with Prussia, which France lost, and I think there was, somehow he got thrown out of power. But he apparently had, I think it was a crown or maybe a set of silverware made of aluminum. because aluminum at that point was much more valuable than gold was. Then somebody came up with a scheme for extracting aluminum relatively cheaply, and in fact, Oberlin College, where my wife went to college, has a mud library, which is sort of a joke at certain times of the year, but it's named after a man called Harvey Mudd, who is the man who apparently figured out the technology for doing things with aluminum, for producing aluminum, and that made him a great deal of money, and he donated some of the money to Oberlin, and they named the library after him. I remember my father saying at one point that universities really were producing two different products, education and monuments, that one of the sources universities get their revenue is by naming buildings after people, and the people are sometimes their heirs and relatives pay to have them done. When I was at Tulane Business School, our very entrepreneurial dean had been raising money for a new building, which they've now built, but after I left. And I remember his telling the faculty that he didn't have an architect's design for the building yet, but he knew how many courtyards it had and how many lectures hall at this class, because he told them all to donors who would have them named after them. Anyway, so that's one of the products. I guess you could argue research is the third one, but monuments and education, or schooling. Schooling is sometimes education and sometimes isn't. Anyway, so I'm saying that if you just try to think about nanotech and why it makes the world different, it seems to me that these are the features that make it potentially a new and different world, very small, very strong, plugging stuff together, and very elaborate designs. And on the one hand, those are the things that make it potentially dangerous, because if once you have the design, making another copy is really easy, then one of the things that gives you is gray goo. And if things are very small, then one of the things that gives you is a new version of military diseases, a new way of killing people with invisibly small things that go into their bodies and make them stop working. Yeah?
Oh. This is behind the military.
Yes.
Those comments that, even though I know we were talking a lot about how the
message
gets things to shift around.
Frozen in flux, it just doesn't destroy it.
Yeah, it doesn't destroy it. It seems at some point, I can't help think at some degree this is happening out, so people made arguments that the reason why the recession and unemployment is perpetuated is that, you know, a whole bunch of people got laid off, and now people's jobs are taken by machines. We don't have enough people to fill the roles of the designer, so to speak. So that's one thing I can see is nanotechnology has it first, that we wouldn't have enough designers, so they would be a very small group of people.
In which case they would be highly paid.
Highly paid, and then because you have, you know, the technology plus the replicators all with the same command, it would put a whole bunch of people.
Any substantial change, if it happens quickly, will mean that some people's jobs no longer exist. On the other hand, there's a tendency, I think, for non-economists to imagine that somehow the number of jobs and the number of people are independent variables. It's just good luck that they match. And it's hard to see how that could be true. Because if you think about American history, our population over the history of the country has gone up, let me say, about 30-fold, maybe 50-fold. It was a few million at the beginning. And yet, except for a few years in the Great Depression, the two number, I'm not sure what the highest unemployment rate was here, but the highest difference between number of people looking for jobs and number of jobs was 10%. That can't be happening if they're independent things moving. It's unbelievable. So that what you really want to think about is when a bunch of people are no longer needed for job X, they become willing to do other things at a lower wage. That means that all of the things that do use labor now choose to use more labor and less of other things, hence the number of jobs. Just the way the number of buyers and sellers of oranges adjusts, because the price adjusts, so the number of buyers and sellers of labor. And it doesn't work perfectly, partly because people aren't willing to say, well, I used to be a nuclear engineer making $100,000 a year. Best thing I can do now is work at McDonald's for $20,000 a year. I'll take it.
And they make it irrational not to, because it's quite likely that you were able enough to be a nuclear engineer, even though you, that job just vanished for some reason, that there's some other job better than working in the government. So there's reasonably people engaged in long-term search, and sometimes they're willing to be unemployed for a while. And more willing, of course, the more you've got unemployment compensation or larger savings or any reasons why college will be unemployed. So I don't see why in the long term you would expect more unemployment, but you would expect different patterns of employment. And it's hard to guess. I mean, you could certainly imagine a society. Suppose the result of the technology was that the 1% of most productive people were each 1,000 times as productive as anybody else. I suspect you would then go back to a society with a lot of servants. All right? Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but if I could find somebody intelligent and competent who was willing to do all the things for me and my household that I don't feel like doing, it would be really nice. All right? Now, there are problems with that. There are reasons, I think, why our society is much less willing to use servants in past societies. Part of those are social reasons, about sort of not feeling comfortable with relations of subordination. I've sort of talked for some time that it would be really useful if people could work out social arrangements which gave you the equivalent of servants among people who thought of themselves more nearly as equal. So if you, just a minute, if you imagine the kind of person who really wants to write novels, and until you're successful, it's really hard to make a living writing novels. Well, that person might be perfectly happy to also do the sort of cooking, house cleaning, and paying the bills for a couple where both of them were well-paid professionals. And if the reason you're doing this is that you're writing novels, not that you're a lower class person without a job, maybe you can do that and still feel comfortable with each other, still feel as though it was sort of a roommate and not a servant. And somehow it does seem to me as though there are real niches unfilled because of the clash between the fact that on the one hand there are jobs analogous to what servants used to do that people would like to pay to have done, on the other hand it's hard to get comfortable when you're doing that for a lot of people. Yes?
So there actually is a program called TaskRabbit. You can get a background check, and basically it's like Craigslist, but for menial servant-y labor, and they literally call them buddies. And it's a full startup like mobile application, and you can go on there and be like, mow my lawn or clean my house, go shopping for me, help me with the office, etc. So they do kind of have that, but it's still something so very new.
But in a lot of that, but we've always had that. So I don't mow my own lawn. I hire people who come in every week and sort of mow the lawn. But it would be a lot harder to have the kind of, let me put it differently. I'm really talking about the kind of things that a wife did in the traditional division where the husband earned the money and the wife ran the house. All right? Well, it's a lot more comfortable to have your wife doing that than to have a servant doing that, at least for modern people, I think. And from my standpoint, sort of the interesting challenge would be finding institutions like the ones you described, maybe not the same ones. But it's not just sort of the economic institution, it's social institutions. You need roles such that the person who is doing that doesn't feel like a subordinate, doesn't feel low status, and people care about their status.
But I'm not too sure, but I think did you also mention that you can get people that have occupations
that
are conducive to doing that.
Like
you mentioned a novelist, yes. I mean, is that part of what you're saying, or?
That would be an example, but this isn't really about nanotech, but this is more nearly about the fact that one of the ways the world could be changed, and I'm not predicting what it would be to sharply change the distribution of productivity. And some people argue that's happening. I think it really is true that the very top of the income distribution is doing relatively substantially better than the average. And all of these numbers are complicated by the fact that everybody uses them for political purposes, and by the fact that the measurements are somewhat ambiguous. You measure it by household, by individual. If you observe that household incomes are becoming more unequal, that might just mean that more poor people are living singly than used to, and more rich people are living in families. All right, that would give you a greater inequality of household income because the poor household would be one person and the rich household would be four people. So it's complicated. But at least some people argue that one of the things that's happened over the last 20 years is that the top 1% or so of the income distribution is relatively richer than it used to be. And you could certainly imagine technological changes that would make that happen, right? If the technological changes are such that talents that are very rare are really valuable. And the less valuable, and the less rare talents become less valuable, for example, because machines can do. And it used to be that being physically strong was a really important market skill. That's much less true in the last century or so, maybe a little bit longer than that, because the things that require physical strength are mostly done by machines nowadays. And so the distribution of productivity of talents can change, and technology is one of the things that can change. And now we're just trying to explore how the world might be changed by that sort of change. Yeah.
Not to pull this further off the nanotechnology, yep. I'll follow it up with a question and bring it back, but I can also imagine different countries choosing to invest more in, I mean, I think that they do, that's exactly what's happening now, at least between us and the East, is that that they're investing more time in, say, making, you know, computer programmers and here there's still this culture of emphasis on like a liberal arts education, and that you could see that distribution happening by country as well.
Yes, but you would think that there would also be a sort of a world shift if it becomes clear that being a computer programmer is a really possible thing and makes you lots of money, that then you would think most cultures would have some tendency to shift towards producing more of those and fewer ditch diggers.
I think that should be happening now, but I don't.
As you'd like it to.
As it should be.
Yeah, might be, don't know.
Yeah.
One of the other things that we aren't really discussing in this class, but that is interesting, is the degree to which things like the internet and computers may destroy the existing structure of schooling. And there are other existing structures. I think I discussed a little bit the ways in which the fairly modest modern technologies could destroy the publishing industry, as people could self-publish. Well, similarly, you've got the Khan Academy as a famous example already, but you could certainly imagine a world with not much development beyond what we now have, where it was clear that the best way for kids to get educated did never involve going to school, that it involved some combination of online education and computer games. One of the ideas, which I think somebody else wanted to take up and make themselves rich, is to take something like World of Warcraft and make it into a game programming language. All right, did I discuss that before? I don't know how you know how World of Warcraft works. It's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And so your character that you're seeing in the screen is moving around interacting with other players, but also with non-player characters that play on the computer. So suppose that when you start, one sentence in 10 by the non-player characters is in French. And it's always a sentence where it's obvious by context what it means. And then after you've been playing a while and your character's moved up a level and everything, now that bit of French you've already incorporated. You know that. That's natural, just like English. So now it's 2 sentences out of 10. And after you've been having fun for a year playing this game and enjoying yourself and killing monsters, you probably will say, you see French very well. All right? So that would be one example where clever people could substitute, not only make a less expensive way of teaching languages, but a better way. It was more fun because, generally, I can tell, most people who study language in high school never learn them. Right? I mean, I took, I think, 2 years of French in high school, and I think 1 year of German in college, and my German ended up much better than my French as a result of both of those things. So, and you have lots of other things of that sort. And sort of, I find it very hard to think of any subject now taught in high school which couldn't potentially be taught either by educational computer programs, or which of course exist already but haven't taken over, or by online education of some sort. So that could be another way that the world would change a lot. So it might turn out that, you know, the schools are doing a terrible job of teaching computer programming, but that doesn't matter. All right. The only computer programming my son knows came from playing StarCraft and related games where you can construct your own maps. And the maps, it turns out, I realize, aren't just a drawing. the maps are also in effect a program, because part of the map is if you move to this square, this happens. If you do this, this happens. That program is not a very fancy program. Kids could end up learning their programming by that sort of thing. Here's actually a rather neat computer program, which is a deliberate attempt to make learning to program into a game. It's called RoboWar. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it. If you have any kids who you think would like to learn how to program, in RoboWar, you're programming a little robot tank, which exists only on the screen. It's not a physical object. And there's a fairly simple computer language, because computer people is basically an assembly language variant. And you're writing the program to control your tank and to tell it where to move and what to do, and if it gets hit, if it takes damage to move away, and to look for targets and so forth. And your friend is programming his tank. And then you put the two pragmatic tanks on the screen and you sit back and watch. You have no control over them. Each one follows its program. Your tank promptly runs into a wall and batters itself to death, smashing against the wall. You then go back and you revise your program and you say, all right, one of the things I left out was a mechanism for detecting walls, and when you approach a wall, turn. Put it back in. So it really is quite a clever job. I don't know how much it's been used, but a clever job of making learning a fairly sophisticated intellectual skill designing a computer program into a children's game. And so that's not manifest. It is one of the sizable ways in which technology could change the world in your life. I am not at all confident that the children of my present children will learn by going to school. It's one possible way. Of course, my children didn't mostly use that. They're homeschooled, and I'm thinking of a more easily generalizable approach to it than current old school. All right, now, you want to get back to that, okay?
Oh, I would...
Or somebody else? Other people?
All right, next thing on my list of things that I thought I would talk about if I couldn't persuade you people to do all the work of the conversation is to mention something I mentioned in passing but sort of interesting, which is Babbage's difference engine. People know about this. Charles Babbage was this 19th century lunatic who invented the computer. And he designed a computer in our sense, but it wasn't electronic. They didn't have that technology. It all moved by moving parts, physical moving parts, rods that moved back and forth to represent what happened to numbers. He never finished building it. It was a very complicated machine. I think he kept revising his design. It finally got built, I think, like 10 years ago or something. Somebody, for the fun of it, maybe a little bit more left. Sometime in the late 20th century, I think, someone took Babbage's design and said, all right, we're richer than he was. We have better machines. And they made it, and I think it worked. And one of the many crazy ideas that Drexler and his people came up with was that you could do a very small Babbage engine. Because if you had a computer where instead of using electronics, you used physically moving parts, but the moving parts were a few atoms each, you can move a significant distance for an object that small very, very fast, because you're talking about moving a more than microscopic distance. And they claimed, at least, that they worked out that you could design a functioning computer that was very, very, very tiny and was working mechanically rather than electrically. And as I remember the description that I heard once, the only serious problem with this design is cooling. Because you've got this structure where sort of every third atom is moving back and forth, and that results in generating a lot of heat, and so you have this picture of this computer the size of a sugar cube with water pouring into it and steam pouring out of it. Whether that's how it would work, I don't know, but it seemed like an interesting and ingenious idea. All right, let me go back to the question of a nanotech economy, where the basic argument that I'm making in the chapter is that it looks rather like a software economy, because duplicating is cheap, designing is expensive. And then we're back where we were when we were talking about the death of copyright a couple of months ago, namely one way in which you get people to make designs is to enforce copyright. That may or may not be doable in terms of the technology of enforcement. If it isn't doable, or if you have other alternatives, another way is some kind of a tie-in payment, that if you think about how the web currently works, a lot of it is funded by ads on web pages, so that you're giving away the product and make... Yeah.
Why can't you patent it?
That's the same problem as copyright. The problem...
Well, it's not a program, right? It's not like a language technically is a physical...
object. So you
object.
You can't patent physical object. You patent ideas.
You can patent the method of putting the physical object...
That's right. You don't patent a machine or a device. You patent the ideas that are embodied in that device. Right?
Yes.
So imagine that my nanotech car has no original and non-obvious ideas.
Okay.
It just has a million hours of designer labor figuring out how to use known ideas to do everything better. So if you think about a car, you can't patent, Honda can't patent the Honda Accord. They may be able to patent some features of it. There may be some things, some ideas embedded in the Honda Accord for all I know that are original, but you can't do it with the machine. So that's why, now, I'm not saying you copyrighted a credit, but of course, 50 years ago, we didn't know you copyrighted computer programs either. That was a, as you may know, a controversy in copyright law, and the only precedent when that issue came up went the other way. The precedent was the paper tape for a player piano, where a player piano was a robot piano, 19th century technology, where you had a long strip of paper with holes in it. And as it went through the machine, air blew through the holes, and that moved the keys to the piano, and so you had a ghost playing the piano. And there was a, I think, 19th century, maybe early 20th century case where the court held that you could not copyright that role because it wasn't a writing. Nobody could read it. All right? And then when computer programs came up, the court split. And some courts held that a computer program counters the right to be copyrighted. Some held, as Percy, who was then the head of the PTO, put it, it's not a writing, it's a CAM, the physical device for controlling something. I don't know if people know what a CAM is. If any of you have ever used a fancy sewing machine, they've got these discs where the disc goes in and out and something moves and that controls the pattern of the sewing machine sews. They're usually using fancy sewing machines. So anyway, and eventually Congress intervened, and the Copyright Act was modified to include computer programs among the protectable things. So what I'm suggesting is that in a world of nanotech, it would make sense to argue on very similar grounds that just as a computer program wasn't really a writing, but it had the features that made copyright make sense for writing, namely it's easy to copy but costly to create in the first place, and that's arguably why we have copyright for writing. Similarly, nanotech designs. Or if you could even say design, they perform the program. Yeah.
So right now we have design patents, more ornamental design, right? But I can imagine expanding that for something maybe not going to capture utility of the design, but actually maybe, level. Like right now, for design patents, it's been sketch drawing, black art drawing. But in this case, you might have like a really good typography or something, like all the details.
But the basic idea of patents, at least, is they're patenting ideas. And although you could, of course, use patent law in the course of nanotech, the design itself is not, I think, an idea. It's much more nearly an expression.
Well, yeah, but you can still protect it. Maybe you can make it your own.
Maybe
the
design.
So one possibility is legal protection. One possibility is something like advertisements, and I've got my fun story about the nanotech car that keeps playing advertisements at you whether you want it or not. Another possibility is open source. You could imagine this being done not on a commercial basis, but by people who want, all I demand is that my nanotech car has in the lower right-hand corner of the diamond windshield, DDF, David D. Friedman, and then everybody will know that I'm the one who designed that wonderful car. And you could think of other things analogous to that, because if the car isn't going to be one person, so what really has is you've got to plug something, you've got to push a button, and it will then say, this car was designed by, and list 73 people who designed the car, and they're getting the ego boost of being credited with the car. And then the last method that I discussed, at least in the chapter, is customization. And that's that you do it in such a way that this particular nanotech device is just for one customer and wouldn't be valuable to another customer. And in order for that to be workable, of course, you need the sort of thing where 99.9% of the cost is the common features, and you can then just change a few things, like whose fingerprint and DNA the car recognizes, in order to make that work. I actually had a project along those lines at one point, which like many of my projects, never got completed, and that was that I had written an economics textbook, a price theory textbook, and had written a few computer programs that were designed to help teach economics. And in each case, the program was not doing what the book was doing, something the book couldn't do, and sort of helping the reader to intuit some relationship. And it occurred to me that it was a very inefficient process, because the ideas that I wanted to teach were the same ideas as all other textbooks in the same field taught. And here I was doing the computer program for only one book. And so the idea was that you could have a firm that created a whole bunch of such programs and then went to the author or publisher of each textbook and say, look, we will provide a customized version in which the programmer would be the same for all of them, but the help file will refer to the comments on page 73 of your textbook, will be edited in such a way as to use the phrases and terms and so forth. Maybe the selection of programs to go with your textbook will be different than somebody else's because you're doing different things. And that struck me as a great idea, but unfortunately we never actually got it finished because I wasn't prepared to do the programming, and the friend who was doing the programming ran out of steam fairly early on. We were going to call our firm Living Paper, by the way, which I thought nicely described what a computer program is from that standpoint. So those are all possibilities. We talked a bit about the nanotech threats, and do people know what a doomsday machine is? I mentioned it in the chapter, and it occurred to me people might not be familiar with the term. I believe that Herman Kahn originated the term. Herman Kahn was a guy who wrote a book called On Thermonuclear War and got a lot of flack for doing that, because the book was essentially a sort of a reasonably cold-blooded and objective analysis of what the implications were of the fact that hydrogen bombs existed. And he tried to look at, you know, what damage would be done, what the strategic results were, and so forth. And he got enough flack for that he entitled his next book Thinking About the Unthinkable, which was continuing the same thing. And one of the ideas he discusses in, I think, On Thermonuclear War is what he calls the doomsday. And the idea of a doomsday machine is that suppose you could make very, very dirty hydrogen bombs. And the proposal, I think, at the time was you put cobalt around the hydrogen bomb and it gets transmuted into something radioactive and that creates huge amounts of cobalt. So what do? You make a whole bunch of these cobalt bombs, enough so if they go off, life on Earth ends. And now delivering them to Russia would be an awful lot of trouble. It's not really worth doing anyway because it's life on Earth and life on Earth ends. So you bury them in the Rocky Mountains. You then have a trigger which will set them off if there's a Soviet nuclear attack on the U.S. You tell the Soviets about this. You now no longer need a strategic air command. You no longer need defensive missiles. You set things up so if they attack you, the world ends, so they won't attack you. All right? And that was what we called doomsday. And he was not proposing to do it. He was arguing we really had done it. That if you think about what was referred to as mutually assured destruction, it was a less pure and elegant version of the same idea, namely the reason that we will retaliate against the Soviets if they attack us is not that it'll do us any good at that point, but that the knowledge that we would retaliate if they would attack us. Right? So it was sort of the pure form of therefore a sort of a thought experiment or a way of thinking about it. And some of you may know that the idea then showed up in the film Dr. Strangelove. I'm not sure if one of the characters was intended as a parody of Kahn or not. But in Dr. Strangelove, it's the Russians who build one. Meanwhile, a crazy American Air Force officer decides that the U.S. should launch a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union. And unfortunately, the Russians haven't told us about their doomsday machine because they're saving the announcement for the premier's birthday at the world end. I should say, for anybody who's seen the movie stole its plot from a book,
which I thought was better. The book was called Red Alert. And the book is better because the American Air Force officer is a sympathetic character, the guy who wants to be. And he is somebody who was in Eastern Europe when the Soviet Union came through at the end of World War II and saw all sorts of terrible things being done by Russian troops. He doesn't want to see those things happen in America. And it is his professional opinion that the Soviets are getting relatively stronger compared to the U.S. over time, and eventually will be able to conquer us. And it's also his professional opinion that that instant, the U.S. has a big enough advantage so that we can launch a first strike and take out most of their forces and thus suffer some losses, but not huge losses. So his behavior is not insane. It's going to kill a huge number of people, but you can understand why he thinks it's justified. And he's willing to pay the price, because what he does is to launch his wing, which is a very large part of the Strategic Air Command, send the message to his superior saying, I've launched them and you can't stop them, so you might as well follow them up and finish the job. And he then kills himself. And he kills himself to make sure he can't be forced to give the information necessary to recall him. So in that sense, I mean, to me at least, as a reader, I'm much more sympathetic with a guy who murders other people if he's willing to murder himself too. So that demonstrates the nonsense thing. So I thought it was a better book than whereas in Dr. Trangle, he's just a nonsense. That seems to be like that stuff. He really made a dramatically effective black comedy kind of thing. Anyway, that's what a doomsday machine is, so you want to know. I should say, Colin also has an improved version. He called it a doomsday and a hurry machine. And the doomsday and a hurry machine, which is a little harder to build, is one where the trigger not only goes off if the Soviets attack the U.S., it also goes off if they seize West Berlin. If they do any of some list of things that we don't want them to do. And now we don't need conventional military either, because now they'll be in charge of all of those things. And of course, the doomsday in a hurry, because it's a good deal more likely that one of those things will happen. And of course, the real problem happens if both sides build doomsday in a hurry machines and their programming is not consistent. So the Soviet machine will blow up the world if they don't get West Berlin, and our machine will blow up the world if they do. And now we're finished. But anyway, if people are curious, I think Colin's books were actually quite interesting to read because he was willing to think rationally about things that everybody else was saying are so horrible that it's evil to think about them, and that's the things we were worth doing. But that's where the concept of fiction come from. And it came into the book because I was imagining that one possible source of gray goo is it could be somebody's doomsday machine. Doomsday machine by a lunatic who wanted to end the world, but you could also imagine, think about Iran at the moment. Suppose you're a country which is sizably weaker than your opponents, which believes your opponents are trying to push you around, and which is desperate. So one thing you could do is to say, all right, we will show you that if you insist on attacking us, on launching an attack on us, the world will end. And because of regular things. So you could imagine it seems to me, again, not insane people. I mean, I think it's too easy to reject crazy outcomes as are coming from crazy people, and crazy outcomes come from sane people who are just in very difficult circumstances, so to speak. So anyway, so that's where one of the places it comes from. But the much more likely sources of the gray goo, it seems to me, are accidents where you could imagine easily enough that somebody designed something either for military purposes or for peaceful purposes, and makes a mistake. And that's sort of the story of the internet worm that you probably don't. You might know, most of you probably don't know, but in any case, the internet worm was sort of the first equivalent of the virus problem we now have, but it was back before personal computers, so it was networked Unix computers, but basically a guy who was a very good computer nerd designed a program which was supposed to demonstrate sort of the risks of self-replicating computer programs going through a network of computers, and it was designed so that after it replicated a small number of times, it would stop. And he made apparently a small mistake, and like 150 Unix computers ground to a halt as they were spending all their time making copy after copy of this program. Now you have
There's another interesting book by Kurt Vonnegut called Cat's Cradle that discusses this exact thing. I don't know. I-9, something like that. That, yeah, well, it's solid at room temperature, and if it comes into contact with any liquid water, then it creates that kind of seed.
But I no longer remember either why it's created or who ends up ending the world with it.
his kids have access to it, and I can't remember either. It's been a few years since I read it, but yeah, all of his kids have access to it for whatever reason, and one of them is just wildly, or all of them are wildly irresponsible, but I just commentary on these kind of things anyway.
This depended on, the idea of I-9 is that there are actually several different phases of water, and this is an imaginary one, which is solid at low temperature. Therefore, once you've got a seed of it, all the water freezes, basically. It doesn't get cold, it just gets fine. All right, other comments? All right, fine. Go think about that. The world you will be inhabiting.
Which might be much better or much worse than the world that we are now inhabiting.